State Affairs come to order. This is a meeting that was convened to the recess of the call of the chair. We are going to adjourn that meeting, which began Wednesday. And so that the meeting is a clerk clear on that. We will meeting adjourned. The Senate State Affairs come to order on the date of April 16th, 2015. After delay caused by my absence, we are convening at 9:18 a.m. We have members present, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, Stoltz, and Senator Huggins. Senator McGuire is attending family emergencies. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the McGuire family and their larger extended family of friends, as she is by her father's side. And so, Liesl, our thoughts are with you. But we have, we'll get through what bills we can today. We're very pleased to have been waiting for receipt of the House vehicle for the public employee Roth contributions bill. Mr. Boucher, are you going to be presenting that? Welcome to join us. Pardon? Yeah. Well, we can do it tomorrow or next week. I was told one of my critics said I not to joke to get Senator Huggins' approval. I think I already have a strong friendship and relationship with him, but my critics out there, I love them all. Welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I got to tell you, baseball season, I think of your dad, and
I know we all
miss him.
I do too, Mr. Chairman. I miss him terribly.
Please go.
Thank you very much, members of the committee. My name is John Boucher. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Thank you for the opportunity today to introduce this legislation on behalf of Governor Walker. Before you today for your consideration is House Bill 135, an act establishing a Roth contribution option for public employees who choose to participate in the deferred compensation program. This legislation enables plan members to take control of one portion of their retirement portfolio that they currently do not have a choice over. And essentially, that's the timing and of the taxation of the contributions that they make to their deferred compensation plan. The current statute has been in effect since 1973, and the statute currently only allows deferred compensation to be made as part of a pre-tax contribution. HB 135 is an effort to modernize and update the options that are available to members of the plan to comport with changes that have been made on a national level with other deferred compensation plans.
Are these new opportunities we have because of federal laws?
Include
that into your testimony more
correct.
Specifically.
It is a new opportunity. In January of 2011, Congress passed legislation enabling governments to implement a designated Roth contribution option, and HB 135 would allow for the incorporation of this option into public employees, to public employees who participate in the state of Alaska deferred compensation plan. The bill enables members to control the timing of the taxation of their deferred compensation contributions, whether it be at the time that the contribution is made to the deferred compensation plan or at the time of distribution. Should HB 135 pass as proposed, it would enable members to choose to have their contributions taxed at the time of contribution, which would mean that the income could be considered tax-free at the time of a qualified distribution. The default option for existing members would be the current pre-tax plan, and members would have to positively elect to change to a Roth investment to have their contributions changed to a taxable status. This proposed legislation is in response to requests from members to the Division of Retirement and Benefits to offer this option to members, and we've provided the committee a list of frequently asked questions. I hope those are in your packets.
Mr. Boucher, you say you accept the request. Can be more specific? Was it organized employee groups? Was it individuals? Can we put some of that on the record of our public?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. My understanding, it was individuals who requested this.
The governor's hotline deal?
I'm
not trying to be flip. I'm just trying to
understand
the origin.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. No, it's my understanding that individuals would like to have this option added to the portfolio.
And has there been any formalized requests from any employee groups or retired groups? And I know public testimony may yield that, or just how this was developed.
Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, I'd like to have Kathy Lee from the Division
of Retirement Benefits. Why don't you have her join you there? Welcome.
For the record, my name is Kathy Lee, and I'm the Chief Pension Officer of the Division of Retirement and Benefit. Mr. Chair, these requests have come through us, or come to the division through our regional counselors who travel all over the state and meet individually with members, and this is an option that was published a couple years ago when Congress actually inaugurated the bill, and so it's been a topic of conversation that has come back in reports from our counselors.
Thanks. That's just the historical perspective and the rationale. It's an important part of our public record as we're. It seems to be broadly supported, but it's good to put on the record what the origin. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you.
And welcome. We're joined by Senator Wilikowski.
Are there other states? Is this common among other states to do this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, more states are adding a Roth, designated Roth option. I believe at the last conference I attended, there were about a dozen that had.
Senator Wilikowski?
So I guess is the maximum like $17,500 for, is it the same as what the current amount that you're able to defer?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the current limit is $18,000, and the Roth option takes on all the rules and contribution limits of the deferred compensation plan.
Could you stack them? Could you do 18 for deferred and 18 for Roth? Or could you split it 9 and 9?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, you can split your pre-tax and post-tax options any way you would like, as long as you don't exceed the $18,000 limit.
Mm-hmm. Senator Coghill?
I didn't know that. Good answer.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you. I think there's a program called 403B, right, for educators and healthcare workers. What's the roughly the two or three differences between the Roth IRA and the 403B?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I have to admit I'm not all that familiar with the 403B, as that is not a plan that we administer. I can certainly get that information for you.
If you would, just, I mean, I, number one, if you would do that. Number two, every so often I talk to different employees, and one of the common complaints or concerns is whether or not they draw Social Security. And would you just tell us for the record why our public employees that aren't covered by Social Security, how that came about officially?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I may not get the dates exactly correct without my resource material here, but in the early 1950s, the state had an opportunity to come into Social Security for its teachers, and the option at that time was if you already had a retirement plan for teachers, you did not need to opt into Social Security. So the state of Alaska signed an agreement with Social Security that their teachers would not participate. Many states did the same. And for state employees, in 1980, the state employees held a referendum vote, and it's allowed by Social Security as to whether or not they would participate in Social Security or a Social Security replacement plan. So the Alaska Supplemental Benefits Annuity Plan is the state's replacement for Social Security. That option to choose has sunset. Social Security only allows that option now for a new entity. So like when we have a borough and a city merge, they become a new entity, then they have a chance to decide whether or not they want to participate in the supplemental benefits annuity system or Social Security. But absent something like that, they're locked into whichever one they're in.
Thank you. And if I might, Mr. Chairman, in the case of the teachers, my assumption is that the teachers either supported the state not opting in or they opposed it. I would think that the government would just unilaterally make a declaration. Do you have any history of that?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, we don't have anything on record that says what public comment or anything was. And personally, I have no knowledge because I think I was just born.
Then.
Thank you.
Wilichowski.
Would this have the same investment options? Well, first, I assume that it would be treated like deferred comp in that it would there would be a separate state account that you have. Or could you direct this to your personal Roth that you have, number one? And then number two is, if there is a state account, which I assume there is, would it have the same investment options as are currently offered by SBS and deferred compensation?
Through the chair, Senator Wilichowski, this is an option within the state's deferred compensation program. So you would not be able to direct it to a private IRA, and this type of option is only allowed in a 457 plan because the limits are higher for contribution. It is a taxation option. So the investment lineup that are in the deferred compensation plan don't change. It's the same investments.
So same, if I can,
please.
Same investments as deferred comp currently exist, correct?
Senator Wilichowski, through the chair, correct.
Okay, and then one more question. When an employee leaves state service, would they have the option of taking that Roth and rolling it into their own private Roth that they may hold?
Through the chair, Senator Wilichowski, yes. This is a rollable product. It can go into a Roth IRA.
Is there any opposition to this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilichowski, not that I'm aware of.
Just another employee option, it looks like to me.
Correct. It's just another. I think my personal view on this is that it's just a matter of how you view the future of taxation. Would you rather have a certain rate now or an uncertain rate in the future? It could be a vehicle, for instance, to set aside a tax-free portion of your income for your heirs or something like that as well. So just another tool, I believe.
So it's a post-tax issue that is continued at the same rate that you can contribute off of your payment stub? Is that the option that you would select?
Correct.
All right.
Through the chair, Senator. Yes.
But it's kept at the same rate that the day you started? Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying that because of other IRAs, you pay the penalty on the present day tax? So that's when you said the same tax rate or the risk of changing the tax rate. I know that if you put in pre-tax, you pay a penalty if you take it out earlier than a maturity. So how does that work with this one? You pay post-tax. Is it at the same rate that you start at, or does it follow the tax all along the way?
I'd have to. My understanding, first of all, is that, through the chair, Senator, is that if you were to pay a penalty, that you would pay at the tax rate at that point in time.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the question, though, is I thought this was a post-tax contribution instead of a pre-tax contribution. You've already paid the tax on it when you put it in, right?
Well, that's, through the chair, that's correct, yes.
And so at that, once you start it, do you pay at the rate that is whatever the government figures the rate is annually? month by month, or is it kept at the same rate that we start at? That was kind of the question I was thinking.
I'd have to defer. Yes.
To the chair, Senator Coghill, you're taxed as you make the contribution. So whatever your tax rate is for that pay period, that's what you would be taxed at.
Yeah, and it confused me, the first answer, so I wanted to make sure that was the case. But it is a contribution that you can sign off on, saying I want to take, you know, 5% of my annual or weekly, biweekly pay and just sign it over to this 457, right?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, that's correct. This is a positive election that the employee has to make.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, and my understanding is that you pay the taxes on it, and then you've just got this excess money of $18,000 or so, and you can decide to put that in Roth. And you can take it out any time you want. You can take it out the next year. You can take it out in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years. Is that correct? Or is there a time limit that you have to wait for to be able to take it out?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, there are some restrictions on removing the money. That are different from a personal IRA. Number one, you have to, for this to be a qualified distribution, you have to have had the account for 5 years. You have to have maintained the account for 5 years. You can take it out in the event of disability. A survivor can remove it, or when you're 59 and a half and you've terminated employment. That's the removal options. And as long as you meet those qualifiers, then any investment earnings on those contributions is not taxable.
And then, maybe I misstated my question. You could take it out within the first 5 years or for if you wanted to go out on a vacation or something, but you just, what would happen is you would have to pay a tax on the dividends or interest. Is that the way, that's my understanding of how it works, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, in a deferred compensation plan, you cannot remove the money unless you are terminated from employment.
Is this set up, you can borrow on the money and repay it? Can it be used as a loan account that you can pay an interest to yourself?
Mr. Chair, our plans don't allow for a loan option. A loan option is considered leakage from your retirement plan. So it's sort of like robbing from your future. So our plans do not allow loans at this point.
Yeah, that's a policy decision you've made in presenting the bill and offering these programs.
Mr. Chair, that was a policy decision the legislature made when they created the deferred compensation plan.
I assume it was with a lot of guidance from the Department of Administration. Mm-hmm. We're not that smart.
This is a governor's bill. I mean, it's not a legislative bill. So, I mean, it's nice to always defer. It's a policy. I think both of you know how it works here, that there's incredible input and 100% implementation by the administration. It's almost sometimes a constitutional monarchy. There's a big grin on his face for the record.
No comment. Okay. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other element for people that have, I'll call it the traditional IRA, there was a provision where you could, I'll use the term rollover into a Roth IRA. I don't know whether that was a window or just a program where you could do it for a period of time, but is that still in effect? Let's say I was a public employee, I started a Roth IRA assuming this legislation passed, but I had another IRA sitting over here when I wanted to roll it into my public employee's Roth IRA. Permissible, not permissible?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Huggins, it is permissible to roll in a private IRA. There's only one type of IRA, and that's the simple IRA that cannot be rolled into this plan.
Senator Coghill and then Wilkowski.
So I looked on your questions and answers, and it made me realize that I'm at the place where I could do a catch-up contribution. Help me understand how that works. Do you can you backfill the 10 years' worth? Do you how does that work?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, a catch-up provision comes into play when you are within 3 years of your normal retirement date. And for each of those 3 years, you can double the contribution that is made to your deferred compensation account. So your limit, instead of only $18,000, would actually be $36,000.
Not that I have enough to do that, but it's an option, right?
It's an option, sir.
I can't loan you from my that's illegal. Senator Lefowski.
Just wanted to make sure I understood your answer to Senator Huggins' question. So you can roll, if you have a private Roth, you would be able to roll the funds from your private Roth into this Roth if we pass this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, you can.
Unlimited amounts?
I believe it's up to a certain limitation, but I'm not, right now, I'm not too sure what that limit is.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll just stand briefly at ease here. Senate State Affairs come back to order after that brief at ease. You know, any closing comments? You're not selling, you're closing right now.
No, thank you. No additional comments, Mr. Chair.
Because there's two members wavering, I just want to make your pitch.
I believe, Mr. Chair, that this is a fantastic option for people who may want to choose to have a portion of their retirement income not taxed or taxed now and not taxed in the future.
And we won't ask Department of Administration Emeritus Holtberg to comment because she's here for another bill. I saw the fiscal note there's no cost. Am I missing any fiscal notes, Mr. Persinky?
No, Mr. Chair.
And that's a double pinky swear on that, no cost?
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll come out of the Deputy Commissioner's office if it is. Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity to comment on this and learn more. So with that, I'd move that we move the House Bill 135 out of committee with individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Hearing no objections, always a pleasure to see Department of Administration here, and send our regards to Commissioner Fisher. We're looking forward to taking that asterisk off of the name, the extension some people put on there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we are holding confirmation hearings, despite what your administration thinks. I just want to let you know we're honorable people, I hope you know.
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay. We'll stand briefly at ease while we sign the report.
Senate State Affairs come back to order. We have Senate Bill 74, Medicaid reform, cost containment, cost control, general fix-up, public assurance bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Pete Kelly, and we've had some comments on the record, presentations. I'm happy to answer any additional questions that the committee may have.
And please, just for folks listening, just lay out the overlying principles of this as we've had some iterations and this year.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. The concept of SB 74 is to slow the growth of our Medicaid program. Our Medicaid program is growing at a very unsustainable rate, which puts the entire program in jeopardy for our most vulnerable Alaskans. And SB 74 is an attempt to make sure that we have safeguards in place for our Medicaid program, which we are federally obligated to provide. And just that we get payment reforms in place, we try some new concepts like managed care, really do reforms that we have started, but we really have a lot farther to go. So this is just a new day and a bill to start us down on that reform process.
So not to put a fright into Ms. Holtberg, irrespective of whether an expansion bill passes, this is a good policy measure.
Chairman Stoltz, in our mind, this is absolutely a good policy call. As the former administration, the current administration testified in this committee just yesterday, the current program is unsustainable as it stands. If we don't reform, I don't know what's going to happen to our Medicaid program.
I had asked the department for what the projections are. We've got it. We've got numbers in the past from legislative finance, from independent groups, and I think just want members to know what the cost projections are in the future. I think we finally got that document after multiple requests, and I wanted it to actually come from Health and Social Services. Again, they still didn't put any denotation of ownership on this, so. It's been a frustrating process trying to just point out, even without expansion, what the growth and the sustainability challenges are. I don't know what the resistance has been from the department to claim, from their department. I think they have a very capable OMB division there, and it's been frustrating. I don't know if you've shared those frustrations.
Chairman Stoltz, working on this bill with the department, they have been pretty open with us. We've gone back and forth on the provisions we agree on and disagree on. I do know they paid for this Evergreen Economics Report, so it was sanctioned by the department. I will also say that OMB has been excellent about providing some fiscal note help, and our Legislative Finance Division, Amanda Ryder, did some great projections that should be included in your packet, and she gave a presentation and Senate Health and Social Services on the projections as well.
I wasn't trying to pick at a scab or anything, but it's just fiscal realities as we're talking about sustainability, and I didn't want them to come back and question, well, this is your numbers. It's been frustrating. I just want to. They're not here, and maybe Mr. Sherwood can do his mea culpas of why they don't want to take ownership of the. Of just a simple economic fact, and it makes, you know what, it just causes suspicion in the whole discussion about why there's an aversion to say it's going to cost money, and that's and certainly we've given ample opportunities for them to say what they expect to save through that and so forth. It's been part of the discussion, but taking the blinders off and recognizing that this is a growth part of the budget, it sure causes me suspicion, and it just kind of takes that strong bond of trust we have and just puts a little kink in it. Just a little simple thing like this is averting the discussion of what the growth is right now, and it really makes it even more imperative that irrespective of what passes, that reform and cost containment measures go forward. But if I've had that editorial part out and I've vented my frustration, we'll let you step aside and Mr. Sherwood will come up and talk about the bill, and I know he's been monitoring all our discussions, sitting in the room most of the time. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Commissioner Davidson regrets that she's unable to be here for this hearing. She got called away at the last minute. With regard to the question about the budget, I do want to apologize because I do not, it was never our intention to hide the numbers.
You are now on the obligation. You're going to audibilize year-by-year growth because of this, and it's not a punitive thing, but we're trying to extract for the public record. You are going to go year-by-year with the projections about the growth. So it's all on the stated record, and that's not, it's out of frustration that we have to do this because you didn't even put a ownership on this, so that's, to serve the public, you were going to do that now.
Mr. Chairman, we provided the briefings.
Back to order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the chart we provided, you can see that this shows the spending from 2014 projected out to 2034. In 2014, the spending is approximately $1.5 billion. It grows at 2016. It's about $1.7 billion. At 2018, it's just over $2 billion. At 2022, it's approaching $2.5 billion. At 2024, it approaches $3 billion. At 2026, it's a little over $3 billion. At 2028, it appears to be a little under or right at $3.5 billion. At 2030, it's approaching $4 billion. At 2032, it's about $4.2 billion. And then at 2024, it's $4.5 billion. At that point, the general funds component is just a little over $1.5 billion in general funds by 2034.
Assuming the federal government keeps all of its obligations.
Assuming that the match rates stay approximately where they are.
No, that was pretty easy, and I appreciate that being on the public record because it's now that's absent any expansion, for the record.
For the record, Mr. Chair, this is a forecast absent any expansion or any other changes to the Medicaid program.
Thanks. No, that's on the record, and I appreciate that. Please proceed with your commentary. We are very sincerely interested in even though the Finance Committee will continue the deliberations at Senator Kelly's bill, we want to allow you to put on the record, continue to put on the record, areas you support and areas that you believe are that that you don't support or have issues with, and we'll clearly delineate the record on that and allow the public as well as the next committees to have it. So it's your show, Mr. Sherwood, and editorials are allowed now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you know, I believe the commissioner went through the areas of particular concern. We had identified yesterday. The brief summary is we wanted to make sure we understood the intention of Section 2, which requires a computerized income asset and identity eligibility verification system. And just to be clear, we've moved forward on the assumption that this would be a separate component that would be an adjunct to our existing eligibility system, which is a computerized system that specifically did this verification process. There are products out there that can do that sort of thing, and we have developed a cost estimate of what it would take to add those. I think as we stated earlier on line four, where the department is instructed to pursue new payment processes, we recommended using an or rather than an and when the different processes were articulated in case we had some potential conflict between some of the methods. And finally, we would not support Section 5, which would require us to get prior legislative approval before we added any mandatory Medicaid coverage groups added to the Medicaid program after March, on or after March 23rd of 2010. So those were our concerns and our positions on the bill. Generally, this bill contains a number of items which we think are very beneficial reforms, and we would welcome an opportunity to pursue those reforms. And I'm certainly willing to answer any questions I can.
Thank you, Mr. Sherwood. On the issue, and it's our intent, I'm going to see if there's a motion to move the bill forward. It's Senator Kelly's bill, and they've worked closely with it, and it's we wanted to put a lot of these concerns on the record, and certainly any member can make amendments and so forth. But it certainly appears to me Senator Kelly is operating on extremely good faith and cooperation. If you think there's a different strategy going on, we'll leave these issues for the deliberate with the sponsor in the next committee is our intent as we allow this to go forward. And it was our role to help facilitate some of the issues discussions and put on the record. I have a major policy question on the issue of privatization and outsourcing some of the things that maybe government doesn't do well or doesn't want to do well, just by institutionally, inherently. Sometimes, when I've been reading about some of the states, Illinois has been very aggressive, and a different set of eyes outside of the institutions that are providing, and it's in their interest to keep expanding, and can have been very vigorous and strenuous too, I think, looking at finding fraud where maybe there just wasn't as much motivation among state governments. I know there were a lot of how this administration came together. There's outsourcing might be a dirty word, but it's, does the commissioner and department, and as much as you can speak to the governor as a priority, allowing the most analytical sets of eyes that have records of have a proven track record of finding savings, ferreting out inherent abuse that sometimes you just don't see even though it's right in front of you? That's a broad question, but any commentary on that?
Through the chair, I think our department and the Medicaid program is always willing to consider outsourcing of activities where it's permissible under federal law. There are certain restrictions around, for example, that eligibility determinations need to be made by a civil servant. We currently have outsource our a substantial number of our Medicaid audits. We outsource a substantial amount of our third-party recovery efforts, and we've generally been instructed as part of our budget process by the administration to consider where there are other cost-effective opportunities for outsourcing. So I don't think there's any general philosophical opposition to outsourcing, as long as we can ensure that the programs are operated appropriately and that it's will be cost effective and that we will get the outcomes we're desiring.
I just know a lot of things that government says they can't find out. A talented person, maybe with a fifth grader, can look and find Facebook or a Google search, and somebody that says they're on they have a Medicaid eligibility, and they're talking about the money they spent on the families on a vacation in Cosmo. And I'm not trying to bring up the pejorative lifts, or this is our new powerboat we just bought, and things that are just counterintuitive. Did you find that an intrusion to have somebody? I mean, there's so much technology out there that folks can do. And government, frankly, they're not always interested in the best motivations of finding the fraud, or as it's really you're trying to stack more people onto benefits, and that's one of the motives. And that's anecdotal, but it's also shown in other jurisdictions. They've used things like social media and Google, just something as simple as a Google search and looking up some of their economic assets, and people say and do the stupidest things on Facebook.
Mr. Chair, I certainly our department has over the years done an extensive amount of verification and looked for opportunities to find not just the most obvious forms of ineligibility, but looking at what they're seeing in a thoughtful way. An example would be when you see assets that appear to be associated with income-generating activities, but you see no income. That would be cause for additional investigation. Some of the things that you're talking about with some of the newer social media may well present some opportunities. I can't say that I have specific examples of how we're using that, but I think we're always going to be open to both internal or as we see them developed externally, some external opportunities to take advantage of new technology. I think there are some, as you move forward, we'll have to look at some of the issues of privacy and also some of the issues of equity. Whenever we do this kind of work, we have to make sure that we're doing it in a thoughtful and an equitable manner, and we're not sort of singling out people for the wrong sorts of reasons. Those qualifiers, I think there may well be some opportunities. I can't really tell you much about what those opportunities are today, but I think it's certainly something that we will probably be looking at in terms of what our different opportunities are. Since I've taken this new position, a number of people have wanted to meet with me and talk to me about their various services that they offer. And I'll be honest. I think the extent to which some of these things can be done has been a little bit of an education to me over these last couple of months.
So I want to put on the record the real substantive fraud abuse cases that have been brought on Medicaid and welfare have been against large providers and institutions. And that's where the real egregious damage is done. I'm much more sympathetic to an individual making a bad decision than a systematic institutional fraud that's by one of the providers, whether it's an individual or a hospital or a clinic or whatever, and certainly none of Ms. Holtberg's clients, I'm sure. But that's, and I didn't mean, I wasn't trying to single out going after
The real fraud is often at the higher level, where it's very much more systematic, and I wanted to make sure that was on the record as well.
Senator Wachowski. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I know legislative staff are not permitted to use Facebook, I guess for fear that it would be wasting our time, and I'm just curious if state employees are permitted to use Facebook in your department?
To the Chair, Senator Wachowski, state employees have to get permission to use Facebook. It's not it's not standard that they have access to Facebook, but if you request a waiver with an appropriate business purpose, you can use Facebook. So a lot of our public information staff would have access to Facebook. I'll confess I don't have access to Facebook through my state account, but we do have individuals who do have access if they have a legitimate business purpose, but otherwise no, they're not routinely granted access to Facebook through the state resources.
Senator Coghill.
I was listening to Becky Holberg the other day, and the uncompensated care is something that has come up, and I know enough to be misinformed, and I know enough that there's something out there I need to know more about. So I know that the federal government gives disproportionate share to hospitals, and that's based on population. Is that something you manage? I do know, I think, not credibly, but I am pretty sure that I heard that it's going away under the Affordable Care Act. But is that something that you help calculate, or is that something that the hospitals calculate?
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, there is two kinds of disproportionate share payments. One is a Medicare payment, and the state does not have any direct involvement in that. The other is the Medicaid disproportionate share payments, and those are calculated by the state based on the ability. There's a calculation as to how much an institution is eligible to receive, and that calculation is done by our Office of Rate Review. So,
Mr. Chairman, I know that on the uncompensated care, the hospitals are getting, and the disproportionate means higher than the regular Medicaid payment. What is that formulation?
Through the Chair, Senator Coghill, I could not tell you the specifics of the formulation. In Alaska, we have historically not allocated all of our federal dish allotment because we did not have the matching general funds to go along with it. Our current dish payments are targeted toward the Alaska Psychiatric Institute to the maximum extent allowed by federal law, and to I believe it's three other classes of hospitals that provide psychiatric services. Ms. Holtberg may have the information handy. I don't have it handy, but we can provide more detail to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I just remembered through some of my discussions down through the years that was something, and I know that under the Affordable Care Act, I think it has a step-down provision. But I know that some hospitals have gotten it, and I know that Fairbanks Memorial, because of it providing psychiatric care, has a calculation in there. And I can I honestly know that I don't know what it is, and I don't even know if it's calculated, but I just know that it's over the regular Medicaid rate by some, I think it's around 25% or something, based on billing volume, I think. But that's part of the uncompensated care flow that comes through there. And so I think that because of the Affordable Care Act's makeup, that was supposed to dissipate. But between that and bad debt, and this is probably something for, I'll just say it to Becky, and something that you need to deal with as they get into the Finance Committee, it's something you should probably at least say the uncompensated care is in these chunks, and this is how we get it, because my guess is the hospitals are paid fairly well by Medicaid, even though we've had a glitch in our system, the smaller payers are the ones that have felt the heat more because of the lag in our system, payment system. Then I also know, and this is also for Becky, that they're able to shift cost within the hospitals. As I've talked to my own hospital, I know that they can, when we start talking about an imaging center, they said, no, don't take that away from us because that's how we pay for things that are uncompensated. And so that's something that should be laid out at least in chunks so that we get it better. Because if it's $100 million in all one chunk and it's all for the poor, I think that's a picture that needs to be painted a little better. And anyway, that's so something that when we get to the Finance Committee with this, that should be shown in the real chunks of dollars. Anyway, just for my input.
And the hospitals haven't exactly been always pure on this. There was a new medical regional center built in the Mat-Su Valley, the Mat-Su Regional Center, and Providence Apparatus opposed the CON for that pretty systematically. It was eventually approved, and apparently the competition in hospitals retaining those profit centers support Providence built a imaging center right in plain front view in the front yard practically of Mat-Su Regional Hospital. So these pure arguments about their altruism is sometimes a little lost on me, and I guess it's again, we see they're well represented in the room and very capably represented, and sometimes they don't need as much help from us as they say. They have a lot of tools on their own, but I'll call that editorial. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The $100 million in uncompensated care, do you have any estimate of how much that costs the average family in Alaska? I guess that's question number one. And do you have any sense of how much the average Alaskan would save if we were to expand Medicaid? Because right now that $100 million is just spread among all Alaskans, right?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I don't have any estimate of cost other than sort of doing the simple division of the amount of money and the number of people in Alaska. But in the sense of trying to calculate exactly what would happen to other rates, either for private pay or for insurance, I don't have estimates of that. Nor do we have a solid estimate that I'm aware of the specific amount that those rates would go down if we did Medicaid expansion.
My understanding is that a significant portion of Alaskans, I think it's 65-70%, already receive government health care. And every single person that works in this building gets government health care, state workers, federal workers, military members, many veterans, Medicare recipients. Do you have an estimate of what percentage of total state population is on government health care already?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we may have that number. I don't have it with me that I could give it to you off the top of my head.
I'd be interested in seeing that and the breakdown. I don't need it right away, but I'll get a chance.
And I'm going to circle back to that issue of the privatization aspect, and it's not for the sake of privatization which is different merits. Sometimes it works well on some others, but just in a system where where you really want to add people on, and there's finding and making sure that there's some type of a mechanism that's watching out for the institutional fraud before it gets very far, because that's where the real numbers rack up, and making sure that we are serving the Alaskans that are deserving and not that are not potentially cheating the system and through underground economy activities. And that's a real serious concern. Not a punitive measure. Not for the sake of privatization. Because I'm generally a privatization. I have a lot of concerns, but there's some real
specialized folks out there that know how to help ferret out, and they have a will to do it, and they maybe even built in incentives to find where the fraud is. And the state ultimately makes those decisions on whether, but the state wouldn't be able to say they didn't know. And that's is that a without you know? I guess is there a commitment to that type of a of an outside outside eyes on this that have total objectivity just on cost containment? And the hospitals use those types of measures. Sometimes they seem a little sterile, but we're talking about budget deficits in the $4 billion range. You make decisions that aren't always the most savory.
Mr. Chair, I think, you know, first and foremost, the Department and the Administration are in complete agreement that the scarce resources we have should go to meet real needs and not go to support fraud or abuse. And I think, again, we're going to have to be very creative with limited resources in how we manage to meet the basic needs of individuals and still stay appropriately focused on the program integrity of these programs we're operating. And I think there's certainly a role for external entities in that. And I don't mean to be evasive, but you know, I'm not sure we have figured out exactly what that picture looks like yet, but that's a picture that we're working on, trying to figure out how we put those pieces together. And, you know, and I'm very comfortable of saying we're not excluding private entities as having a role in that, and we're actively considering where there may be opportunities to bring additional entities in who may be able to bring up efforts quicker or be more flexible in some cases than we might have through the department.
Yeah, and I understand not making a specific commitment, but just knowing that it's not a theology not to have outside, and I can't predict whether or not you're going to be able to say no to Jim Duncan and all those other external factors. Those are all internal things you have to work out and figure out where the constituencies and the values of the administration rest. And that's Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sherwood, I put this in context. As I recall, this year we're projected potentially to have upwards of $3.9 billion deficit. We'll call it four, round up. And, you know, getting the math wrong can have drastic consequences for us. I'm going to come back to this graph in a moment. A little while ago, when we were doing our investments and our calculations on our contributions to our retirement fund, we made a math error. We got some advice, probably not sound advice, but suddenly, boom, we were $12 billion in the hole, maybe a little more. Big numbers quickly. And I guess I'm going to go back, and I thank you for presenting this to us and the chairman drawing attention to it, but these are big numbers. And I see the red, and I don't get a lot of comfort in the fact that they are paying for it, because they is us. We're one of 50 states. So, I mean, we have, and those guys, us, have, I think, what, $18 trillion debt? I mean, we have 3.9, they have $18 trillion. But your graph, what it shows, my interpretation is that for the lifespan of the graft, the cost involved is 300% of what it was in 2014. Is that about right, total?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, that's correct. The cost approximately triples over the 20 years.
300%. But the important thing for us is kind of like when you're doing the math and you're working on the math, and I'm not saying you're trying to skew the results, but you worked off some assumptions. And it says the lower projected growth is due to cost containment, and you give the administration, you give your department, you give the legislature some credit for that. Slower growth and healthcare price inflation. But those are all assumptions. That's what we're calculating with, how we're doing the math. And the final one is there going to be less of us as far as our growth pattern. I don't know about that. But the difficulty is if our math is bad based on our assumptions, and lo and behold, it grows 300%, it frightens me a little bit because it's still a big number. And so I would say to you, when you look at the cost to the state, how sustainable is our healthcare picture overall when it comes to responsibility of the state and the federal government, in your estimate? Is it frightening? Is it well within, if we take the assumptions you have, is it just we've got it under control, or is it we're monitoring and we kind of don't want to look at the, what's the right picture?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I've worked with the Medicaid program for about 25 years, and you know, in that entire time, we have been actively trying to manage and control costs in the program. Not always our only objective. We have done things like creating the Denali Kid Care program, and also expanding coverage, adding additional services as we see needs. But we have always managed the cost. These projections you're looking at are a projection of what the program would look like in 20 years if we didn't change the program, and historical spending patterns and the Department of Labor projections that we use were to continue and be realized. I would say this graph is concerning. It's a concern I've lived with for 25 years. So I know that there are ways we can change the curve and bend the curve. And if you look at the forecast for that was done in based on 2012 numbers, the projection would for the 20 years out year would have been $6 billion instead of $4.5 billion. So there are trends right now, which include activities we've taken as well as other demographic and economic changes that are working, can move this line down. Additionally, we think the reforms that we would bring to the Medicaid program would also help move this line down. But I think Medicaid is not unique. Healthcare in general has seen that its expenses rise, its inflation go up, its share of the economy increase. That's a concern for all of us, not just within the Medicaid program, but this is something we are going to have to manage and work at vigorously for the foreseeable future. Probably as long as we have a Medicaid program, we're going to have to stay on top of this.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One more question. You said 25 years you've been working on this? 20-something, right?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I started working in the department in 1990, and I've been involved in some part of the Medicaid program that whole time.
Okay, so you're the closest to an authority by experience if we have in the room today. My question for you is, I mean, I look to my right, and these are all compassionate, generous people in one way or another. Could you just give me a look at what we've done, Alaska legislature, our government, the governor, what we have done to Denali Kid Care over time as far as sweetening it, reimbursement, whatever the right term is. Can you kind of tell me the history of Denali
Kid Care? Quick numbers answer.
Quick numbers. Well, we started Denali Kid Care in 1999.
Smart start.
When we added the CHIP option to expand Medicaid for children, we kind of rolled in our existing coverage for low-income children and pregnant women into a package and called it Denali Kid Care. Initially, the income limits were 200% of the poverty level.
Why don't we talk numbers? How much did the program cost and what does it cost now?
Mr. Chair, I can't give you a breakout specifically of Denali Kid Care. In terms of the numbers, it's part of the Medicaid program, and we've tended to budget it as just a part of the Medicaid program.
Why don't you provide that analysis of the growth, and that'll be useful for the next meeting.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Well, thank you.
As much as I love dealing with this bill, we've talked a lot about it, and it's Senate Finance Committee is going to continue to work on this. Is there a willingness to let it go?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make the motion because I've got a meeting in 5 minutes. Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the CS for Senate Bill Number 74, State Affairs, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes with some new fiscal notes that came in today. So,
is there any objection? Hearing none, the bill is moved out with its very expansive fiscal note issues, which Senator Kelly is aware of, and we'll work to tighten those up, I'm sure. We'll miss you, Heather.
We have brief use while we sign that.
Brief it is. Representative Ortiz, I'm sorry, I read the article on that.
It works good.
Yeah, well, the correct one is one we prefer to be in a single syllable name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Honorable Chairman, members, for having me here today to present HGR 22. HGR 22 is a resolution that calls on the Canadian Border Services Agency, or the CBSA, to reopen a border that exists between Hyder and Stewart, Hyder, Alaska, and Stewart, B.C., on a 24-hour basis. As of April 1st, Mr. Chairman, the border between Stewart and Hyder was closed between midnight and 8 a.m. This has created some issues for the 87 residents of Hyder, Alaska, as well as the 500 residents in Stewart, B.C. Issues related to safety for the people of Hyder, who rely on hospital facilities, emergency vehicle facilities in Stewart, and closing that border makes it more problematic to get access to those services. There's also economic issues involved, Mr. Chairman. One of the main drivers of the economy there in Hyder is bear viewing, which takes place on the Hyder side of the border. And there's quite a bit of tourist traffic that travels from on the Canadian highway there into Stewart, B.C. and into Hyder. And generally, that traffic starts before 8 a.m., so there's an issue there. There's also issues related to mining, that both communities are tied to the mine that's on the Hyder side of the border. So there's just issues. And I'll be brief, Mr. Chairman. This resolution just calls on the CBSA to look at their decision and perhaps reopen that border on a 24-hour basis, at least for the summertime. And that's, of course, the peak time when that border is being crossed. I'm open to questions, specific questions that you might have about the resolution. I've been to Hyder, talked to the people of Hyder and Stewart, had a town meeting. I can say, Mr. Chairman, that this is an issue not just to the people of Hyder, but also to the people of Stewart. They're both very much concerned about the decision by the CBSA. I can also tell you that Senator Murkowski's office has been involved to try to push the needle a little bit, and I know that there's a willingness on the part of the governor to support the people of Hydra as well. So that's where we are. That's what the resolution calls for, and I appreciate your support.
Subsequent to you introducing this, has there been an issue raised about changing hours on the Skagway crossing as well?
Not that I'm aware of.
I heard something to that effect, and I would certainly want to. I know, even though it's not always reciprocated, Representative Munoz is an incredible champion of all of Southeast. And given we're lacking a quorum to move anything out here, if there's a chance we'll talk to her office on that. How's daylight savings time playing this whole thing for you guys in Southeast?
The folks of Southeast are happy that we're on hold in this such situation. Let's put it that way.
How does that impact the crossings? Is that going to cause all kinds of
there you go. That hasn't played into the discussions. Hadn't thought about that one. So
I just want to see if you want to poke Anna a little bit. But that, we're lacking a quorum. We've had a multitasking, so I am going to recess to a call of the chair to keep our options open here.
Okay.
I think you're just as observant of the calendar as we are.
You bet.
So that leaves our options open here, and we'll let you know. It could be a very brief meeting if we're able to reassemble. I suspect there'll be other issues that'll compel us to come together for something else.
Okay. I'd appreciate it.
3 days is a short time in the real world. It's an eternity here. Lots of good and bad things can happen. Isn't that right, Senator Willehousey?
Certainly, yes. It's an eternity.
With that, we will recess to a call of the chair.